Well, Yaku, that's her real name.
Wow.
Try saying that three times.
Do it again, I knew it was Agnes.
Agnes Gonka Boyaku is is how you say it. Now, Gonka, Matt, not actually her middle name, is it?
No, we did discover that was a nickname, and what it means is Rosebud.
Rosebud.
And for all you Orson Welles fans, just remember that Citizen Kane is not calling out to Mother Teresa, but actually his
Mother Teresa is calling out to Orson Welles?
Absolutely.
Okay. Anyway, Mother Teresa, of course, is arguably one of the most influential women of the 20th century. And, of course, certainly one of the most widely known, mm-hmm. but definitely one of the most influential. She was the middle child out of a family of three. She came from a very well-off family and came from, obviously, a very devout Roman Catholic family.
Well, it was interesting. They're in Albania, and basically she's growing up under the new communist regime that is trying to consolidate Yugoslavia. This is unfortunate because at 9 years old, her father is assassinated by the Yugoslavian police.
Oh, my gosh. They're just going through. First of all, she's born in a couple of years before World War I.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So now the communists are trying to grab
this
Albania.
This is right after World War I, you know, and the Bolsheviks have taken over Russia, and communism is spreading. And it's a bad time to be in Albania. Quite frankly, I can't remember a good time to be in Albania.
Probably the best time to have been an Albanian was, you know, when it was back in the days of the Roman Empire and Paul visited Philippi.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
That's probably about the last time it was really good to be an Albanian.
Well, bless her heart. She's grown up. Her mom basically is knitting, crochets and laces and everything, and actually ends up getting enough of a living from this to keep the three kids and her alive, and does pretty well, and is extremely active. Her mom is extremely active in ministering to the poor people in her neighborhood. Agnes's brother and sister kind of aren't into this too much, but Agnes very much is into this and follows her mom all around ministering to the poor and really is establishing a flavor of life here that, well, we're going to see repeated as time goes on.
Absolutely. Well, you know, she actually, around age 12, by her own story, says that she believes at that time she received her call from God to just a strong desire to give herself fully to Him and fully to His work of service, and she struggled with this for a number of years.
She didn't want to be a nun, though.
Yeah, and so she kind of filed it away and made it a matter of prayer, which, you know, when you think about 12-year-olds today and how serious 12-year-olds are, it's kind of an amazing thing. But about age 16, there was a youth group that was formed at her local parish. She became very involved with that and confided with the priest who was leading the youth group about her call that she had received, and a bit of confusion and doubt as to whether or not that call was real. And he gave her what I consider just some award-winning advice, and that was, he said, you know, let the joy of the Lord be your inner compass in this. And if serving Him full-time brings your heart incredible joy, let that be your guide. And, you know, when you think about that, I know so many people have, even to me over the years, have expressed a doubt or whatever about, you know, oh, gosh, you know, should I go on this mission trip or should I be involved in this or whatever? I really want to be, but I don't know if it's God's will for me. And I'm like, you know, do you honestly think that, you know, like Satan's going to place it in your heart to go on a mission trip or to serve Christ in some way? You know, we need to take a look at some of those joys and realize, you know, those come from somewhere, and most undoubtedly the Holy Spirit. And so anyway, this was something that really kind of guided her. And in the next couple years, at age 18, at a church service during prayer, she sensed a real calling to go in to become a full-time vocational religious, meaning that she became a nun. And she left Albania and went, of all places, to Ireland, didn't speak English at all, and joined a group called the Sisters of Laredo.
Well, it was interesting because actually, her mom and sister put her on the train, and as the train's pulling out of the station, little does she know that this is the last time she'll ever see her family or visit Albania again. Very interesting time. And they had been looking at the Sisters of Laredo, who were They're stationed in Ireland, but their primary ministry is to the poor people in India. So already we're getting the Indian connection. And she had, even earlier as a child, she'd listened to visiting priests talking about ministries in India. So the Indian thing was a recurring theme for her.
And that so frequently happens too, Matthew, mm-hmm. with people that have a missionary call. Usually that missionary call goes beyond just a general thing, but they actually begin developing an appetite and a heart for the country that they end up as well.
Glad to say a word for China.
Exactly.
Stuff, yeah.
There's always seems to be that accompanying appetite for a particular group of people somewhere. Now, we fast forward, not too fast, you know, one year or so, and she finds herself in 1929 as a 19-year-old novice. Working in Calcutta as a school teacher. So,
wow, she's already in India.
Yeah, just a little background here. This is the British Raj in India, the British Empire still. Mohandas Gandhi is just coming to publicity. The Indian Congress is just starting to really get noisy about Indian independence from Britain. The Great Depression is getting ready to happen, not only in the United States, but all over the world.
Really. Yeah.
So this is ushering her, as she's taking her initial vows to be a nun and is accepting the position as school teacher at this Calcutta school, where she's going to spend the next 16, 17 years?
Almost 20 years.
As she's entering into this, she's entering into a real whirlwind decade.
And she absolutely loved being a school teacher.
And she was good at it, wasn't she?
She was very good. She was a teacher of geography, a teacher of religion, and was also someone that was so by her students. They were not the lower classes, but the middle and upper classes of India that she taught at the St. Mary's School.
These were Indians, though, not
these were
English.
Indians, yes, in Calcutta. And she was well-loved and respected by them enough that many of her students actually began accompanying her as she would labor on the weekends, going out and ministering to street people.
Now, isn't this about the time, Christopher, that did she take her name at this time?
Yes. Really, within the next couple years, she began taking her initial vows. You start a novitiate, and then you have other layers of vows, and then you have your final vows. So she was taking...
takes years to really get through and be a real nun, right?
Yeah, there's many, many years here of this process. And in her initial thing, she takes, at age 21, the name Sister Teresa, and she takes the name after Saint Therese of Lisieux, who was actually only recently canonized by the Roman Catholic Church.
And not very well known.
Not very well known, very well known today, and one of the most well-known and favorite saints, and a woman who actually would have been only about the same age as Teresa was when she died of tuberculosis herself. So that's who she's named after, and she was named after Therese of Lisieux because Therese was considered the patron saint of missionaries, and Mother Teresa, of course, had a strong identification with missionaries.
Well, is it time to, I guess, 6 years later, before she was ready to actually become an official nun?
And so we're talking about 35...
Oh, she's, yeah. No, actually, she's 27 years
27.
Old.
27.
Well, I bet it was 1935. Okay,
1937, so, yeah. I think okay, it was. So it was a couple years before World War II really kicks off. And as soon as she actually becomes a real nun, they promote her to Mother Superior of the school that she's teaching at, St. Mary's in Calcutta. And so she begins to be addressed as Mother Teresa. And, well, by golly, that name sticks.
That name sticks the rest of her life. Of course,
that's what
you know,
they call her.
If I had a name like Agnes Boyacu, I think I'd, you know.
With Blanca in there.
Let's not even go there.
Yeah, I think I'd probably hang on to Mother Teresa as well.
Well, the biggest thing going on now is she spends, India was never really a high-class neighborhood. And as you might imagine, a lot of starvation, a lot of death and disease. Well, World War II cranks that up about three notches. Mm-hmm. The things that happen in India are overshadowed by the hugeness of World War II, but the Great Famine occurs in which 2 million people die. Food supplies are brought down. So here's this gal who is the Mother Superior of the school that she's teaching, and she goes out to help the poor and everything. But the difference between the poverty, the formal poverty of a cloistered nun versus the real grinding poverty of people dying in the streets is just, it's huge. It's black and white. And over this 6-7 year period of World War II and the aftermath, she's really beginning to see that, my gosh, you know, what I'm doing is like a hobby. This is not... I'm not really making a fundamental difference to the people that are dying in the streets of Calcutta. And so this is really starting to bug her and bother her and just kind of churns in her soul over the next few years. And gosh, it wasn't until it was right after the war that India is finally made independent. And if you saw the movie Gandhi, you remember as the Hindus and the Muslims are moving back and forth to their respective new countries, massive riots, death is erupting. It's a bad time to be in India. But it is a time that foments an interesting change in our gal.
Absolutely. You know, one other thing I want to add to that, Matt, was around this time, when she received that big promotion to the Mother Superior, she got a letter from her own mother.
Oh, yeah.
And it was interesting because instead of, you know, a letter of congratulations, it was actually a letter of admonishment from her own mother on this very thing about concern for the poor. And as you mentioned earlier about her mom taking in and caring for someone, there was a woman that of course, Mother Teresa would have been aware of that was in their home. She was a widow. She was an alcoholic. And the mother had taken care of her, and she had tons of health problems. And her mother writes her and said, you know, you need to remember that beyond the wounds and the sores and all the hardships of the poor, there's something deeper. And she reminded her that the woman that her mom had cared for, the deepest wound was not the pain of her disease, but it was the pain of being forgotten and forsaken. Being forgotten and forsaken by her family and friends.
Wow.
And you see that dimension really enter into Teresa's life. And then around age 36, right after World War II, she's believed to have contracted tuberculosis and was heading for a mountain retreat to recover. And on the train trip, she said that the Lord had given her what she calls a call within a call. It was very direct. It was not an option for her, but actually an order from the Lord, and leave the convent and go to live in the slums and serve the poorest of the poor. So a very, something very distinct now. She's making that move from, like what Matthew said, the formal poverty to actually being in the grinding poverty herself.
Yeah, because if you're in a monastery or a nunnery, you're still getting regular meals. Somebody's bringing you clothes and fresh sheets. Yeah, you don't have anything that you call your own, but you're fairly comfortable and well off, as opposed to just the lowest of the low, third world yucco in the streets, flies,
these people are
sewage.
Lowest caste, kind of.
Well,
you know.
It's interesting because if you contract leprosy, it doesn't matter what caste you are. You know, you are instantly transported to the lowest caste. Basically, you know, you reach a certain point and you kind of fall off society's radar screen in India. Every society, us too. I mean, reach a certain point and just society says, oh, well, you know, sorry about that, and out the door you go. So there's millions in this condition.
The isolation, for instance, that people with AIDS suffer, at a certain point. It's a complete forsakenness by society. Very similar circumstance here. Well, she gets eventually, she didn't just walk out the convent. I mean, there was a series of getting permission from her superiors and all that. But eventually, she does get the blessing and permission to leave the convent and moves to the slums with the objective of starting a new order.
Now, I gotta explain here. This is called exclaustration. And that's a big fancy term.
It's not an operation. It's only a procedure.
But basically what it means is a person in orders, a nun or a monk or a clergy, is given permission to go outside of the convent or nunnery and just work out from under the orders. The rules of the order.
Nice Latin
now,
word.
This is pretty darn rare. This was granted to St. Francis and Ignatius Loyola, Dominic, a couple other guys. But no nuns never get this. I mean, you know, a nun goes and asks, you know, can you just cut me loose, let me walk the streets? I don't think so. And so this was an incredible thing that happened. As a matter of fact, her spiritual advisor said okay, and then the Mother General of the Laredo Sisters said, okay, well, you know, if you have a real call from God. But the Archbishop of Calcutta, he was not buying it, and he was really giving her grief over it. Made her wait, 2 years?
Yeah.
And then the Pope got wind of it, and he gave her an okay. So he overrode that, and out she goes. And like Chris says, she not only picked the slums, she went to the worst slum in Calcutta. I mean, it was the worst of the... We're talking Dante's Inferno, yeah. Boy.
And she, you know, she left, apparently left with no more than 5 rupees and a bar of soap. And she herself felt like she was under an incredible satanic temptation during that particular time, because she really was taken aback by the suffering of living. You know, it's one thing to minister to these people. It's another thing to actually live like them. And she found herself stressed out and exhausted. And the temptation was, you know, gosh, go back where you had it safe and mm-hmm. really experience firsthand the miseries. She had to beg herself for food and for shelter and all those sort of things, and really experienced firsthand the type of life of the people that she was ministering to. But she did stick it out and, you know, even started a small school in the slums with 5 kids. She had not even a chalkboard. She had to write in the dirt to teach these kids their letters and their numbers and everything, and taught them basic hygiene and all that. But she started a school and worked with the poorest of the poor.
You know, she actually, even at this time, in that first year, a couple of her old students, gals that had been with her at St. Mary's, actually tracked her down and joined and said, you know what, if this is what you're doing, this is what we want to do too. 2 or 3 of them. One was a med student, I think, even. As a matter of fact, we kind of glossed over, before she actually hit the slums even, she went out to learn a few nursing skills at a missionary hospital, and the brothers there, the monks, they taught her, they spent 4 months, maybe gave her the basics, and then said, you know, really, without equipment, you're not going to be able to do any more than this, so you might as well just go and do it. She did. I think her third gal that joined her was a medical student, and that kind of beefed up the quality of the care that they were starting to give. And very slowly, a parish priest bought them, rented a room for them, so they ended up with a little place they could hide from the rain in. And this characterized the slow growth that was going on. But, boy, it was steady. Every year it was a 50% increase. You know, pretty soon it was 8 girls. Then it was 12 girls. Then it was 21 girls.
And these were just volunteers?
Volunteers, yeah, yeah, that were wanting to join her society.
They weren't necessarily the nuns, right?
When did the Pope do that?
Well, this happens a few years later. Not many, many years later, but a few years later. By the time she reaches 40, which would have been 1950, mm-hmm. her society actually gains official recognition by the Pope, and they're directly under the authority of the Vatican, and they're given the name the Missionaries of Charity. And by that happening, it opened up, of course, a whole world to her, and the whole world came to her. There were women from all over the world wanting to join her order, and so that was a big moment of growth for her. And then in 1952, she buys a former Hindu temple that was dedicated to the goddess of death and destruction, and made it a home for the dying, destitute people of Calcutta. And of course, that's what a lot of us are more aware of, is this latter ministry of hers. And anyway, she renames that temple basically the home of the pure heart, and that begins characterizing her ministry.
And as a matter of fact, you can kind of fill in the details. Over the next 15 years, it's just this kind of growth. She starts leprosariums, you know, she starts orphanages, just specialty houses, and has her girls end up just staffing them, and mm-hmm. people donate things. It just, gosh, it's just a snowball effect, and it's getting pretty huge. So pretty soon, gosh, around 1969, as a matter of fact, she gains the attention of BBC reporter Malcolm Muggeridge.
Malcolm Muggeridge.
Good old Malcolm Muggeridge.
I wish we could talk about He's a fascinating person. He is just very cynical. He was a young reporter that went over to Russia in the old days, and he was the only guy that said, you know, Stalin is killing his people. And everybody liked that. They didn't want to hear that. It was the socialist experiment was a beautiful thing. So he got dumped on for that and punished. And so by the time he gets to Mother Teresa in 1969 for the BBC, he's a pretty cynical, hard-bitten old guy.
Well, she must have had a part in his conversion.
Well, as a matter of fact...
Matter of fact, that's true.
That's exactly what happened. He did a film for her. What was it?
It's called Something Beautiful for God.
Something amazing, beautiful for
1969.
Mm-hmm. We're going to try and find it. We can't. After reading these descriptions, we got to see it. But this catapulted Mother Teresa into world fame. BBC aired this, and people were just floored. And as you say, within a couple of years, Malcolm entered the Catholic Church. He was wiped out by what he saw. He just was floored by the things that he saw. And from here, it just starts picking up steam. It was picking up steam before, but now people are awarding her honorary PhDs. She got the Templeton,
the Nobel Peace Prize.
Oh my gosh!
A couple honorary doctorates, one from Cambridge University. I mean, you know, that's basically how she spent the 1970s. Then in the 1980s and 90s, okay, which is, I want you to think about this. In the 1980s and 90s, she was in her 70s and in her 80s, okay? And she's going full bore during these years.
I mean, she's traveling like a head of state. What is the gig with the airlines she was traveling?
Mother Teresa felt it was too expensive to be buying airline tickets in India to travel to visit all of her missionaries there. And so she wanted to know, and she contacted the airlines and wanted to know if she could work on the planes like they do, serving drinks and everything to pay for the...
I'm sorry, Mother. We can't allow that. I'm very sorry.
I mean, could you imagine this short little woman in a habit and everything? Would you like a scotch and soda?
No, thank you, ma'am.
Anyway, they did end up giving her free airline tickets.
So she got a lifetime free pass.
They didn't want to deal with that image problem, I think. But anyway... in the 1980s and 90s, here she's going full bore. She has two near-fatal heart attacks. Mm. She has malaria. She has pneumonia. She even tries to resign from her order. And anyway, they took a vote, and there was only one vote against her being the leader.
The other 700 votes.
That were to retain her, and the only vote against her continuing on was her own vote.
Yep.
And so she was outnumbered. And had to continue on. And then, of course, there's the famous event in 1994 when she was the invited guest at the National Prayer Breakfast in Washington, D.C. Our president, Bill Clinton, at the time, present for that particular
gathering. It's good to have the popular old lady over, It's a good photo op, here at the prayer breakfast. Uh-huh. So there's President Clinton and Lady Hillary there, And Mother Teresa stands up. She's just supposed to do a little formal thank you. I'm pleased to be here. And she proceeds to read him the riot act for his stand on abortion. She tears that boy up one side and down another. Now, what is he going to say? He's just standing there. He's dying of embarrassment. Hillary's twitching left and right.
Al Gore's looking for some iced tea.
And what can they say? This is Mother Teresa. I mean, she goes where she wants. She says what she wants, and nobody in the world outranks her. So this is interesting. This would have been interesting in by itself. But as soon as breakfast, she proceeds over to the Supreme Court building, where she addresses the Supreme Court judges and says, "America needs no words from me to see how your decision in Roe versus Wade has deformed a great nation. The so-called right to abortion has pitted mothers against their children and women against men. It has sown violence and discord at the heart of the most intimate human relationships, and it has portrayed the greatest of gifts, the child, as a competitor, an intrusion, and an inconvenience."
Wow.
Well, there were some uncomfortable Supreme Court justices, I think, at that point.
Not one to mince her words, huh?
Definitely not one to mince her words.
It's very interesting that at this point in her career, she starts coming under fire for, articles and criticisms about mismanagement of funds. Because, I mean, they're taking in a lot of money by now.
Millions and millions.
And so several people are saying, well, gosh, we don't see any hospitals being built. We don't see any job programs. Well, you had a good point.
You don't expect someone from a third world country to manage money the way a white Western American person would manage money.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't have the value system. She doesn't have the same value system. Money is something to be spent to alleviate the most immediate problem and needs, and she wasn't looking for long-term solutions. She was just trying to buy people a meal.
And just for the record, she's buying meals for over 1 million human beings a day at this point.
Yeah.
1 million people.
Well, she was given a big white, was it a Lincoln Mark something or other?
Mm-hmm.
And it was given to her to ride around in, and she turned around and sold it immediately.
When they were going to do the dinner for her
at the Nobel Peace Prize, you get a big banquet in your honor, to meet you and everything. And she wanted the banquet canceled. And everybody to take the money they would have spent on the $1,000 plate dinner, whatever, and donate it to help with her mission. You know, she was not.
This lady's really wasting a lot of money.
Living in the lap of luxury.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, in 1997, she had just turned 87 years old. A few weeks after that, she ended up dying of heart failure, worn out, and, of course, was given a state funeral by the government of India, which is quite an unusual thing for a clergy to have been honored by the state government of India, and she laid in state. Many of us remember that, of course, because it happened around the time of Princess Diana's fatal car wreck and everything. So these two lives were close together. As a matter of fact, it was interesting because she knew Princess Diana. I guess they had met several times.
Mm-hmm.
And she had actually planned on having a mass for her, and then she ended up dying herself. But she left behind an organization that had 4,000 servants of the poor in 517 different missions in ministering in over 100 different countries, and serving 500,000 families and 250,000 lepers every year. So quite a huge thing for the small little woman from Albania.
Yeah, we don't really have time to go in. I mean, there were some – you could find things to argue about with her theology and her understanding, but, you know –
Are you going to get to this fruit thing again? Is that – is this where this is headed, Matt?
I'm stuck, okay? I'm in a rut. It's the fruit rut. The fact is, you know, what you've got is a little tiny woman – Chris says, from Albania.
I'm not going to argue with.
This lady outranks, I mean, she walks into a room and the kings and the presidents are soiling their diapers. She has a moral authority and a force by living the life of a Christly example. Who is going to say diddly squat?
I wouldn't say anything.
I don't think so, by golly.
I don't want to argue with her.
You know, so it's interesting when people chase after temporal power, political influence. You know, the real route to that is those who honor God are honored by Him. And if you set out to make it your fundamental aim to become like Christ and cooperate with His Spirit, as this lady did, you're going to move some mountains and you're going to make kingdoms tremble.
Well, and isn't it in the Bible somewhere, he who shall be first will be last, he who is last is first. And when you take the low road, Paul said, when I am weak, then I'm strong. When you take the low road, when you go to, you know, you get shipwrecked on the island of Malta, and you're the Apostle Paul, and you go out looking for firewood.
Of course, he got bit by a snake, too.
Yeah, but
that'd be a lesson to him.
Well, that's
but he didn't swell up and die.
That's true.
I know, but anyway, you know, look at the fruit that comes from taking the low road, being a servant. Even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many.
Amen.
So you guys, thanks for pointing that out today.
Glad
Mother
to do
Teresa,
it, Patty.
Wow.
Do we have to unplug the microphones now?
Just about.
Okay.
Is here, so I'll let him do this.
I'll go get the dolly. I'll
unplugging.
See you fellas.
All right, guys. It's Matt McAuliffe and Chris White here today, and we're going to keep doing these shows over in the new location, so don't worry about that. We're going to be back next month, and who's it going to be, fellas?
Who is it going to be? Grab that.
Is it
ever-loving schedule.
Higher criticism thing?
Oh, I hope not.
No,
Constantine. Oh, good. We're going to do Constantine. I didn't even know we were going to do that higher criticism
show. It'll get here eventually.
I'm really good at being critical, so that ought to be a good one.
Okay, guys. Lord bless you, and thanks a lot. Hey, we've got How to Manage Your Money coming up in just a moment here on KDOV.